KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
What is the technology for carbon capture and storage, and can Alaska profit from it and help reduce global CO2 emissions? It may sound too good to be true, but state experts say Alaska's Cook Inlet has the best tidewater access storage for injecting carbon on the entire west coast of North America. There's also a lot of space in aging fields on the North Slope. Alaska lawmakers passed legislation that aims to monetize the potential. How will it work, and what do you need to know about it? We'll discuss the potential for carbon sequestration today on Talk of Alaska.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, proud of its ties to Alaska communities since 1977. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
The greatest compliment to a public media station is when a listener becomes a member. So do your part today by becoming a part of the team officially. Thank you for making a donation.
Get your weekly look at the trends, policies, and issues that impact your wallet in Alaska with the Alaska Economic Report. From local businesses to fiscal policy to big industries like fishing, tourism, and oil and gas, I'll cover the high-stakes economic issues that matter to Alaskans all over the state. That's the Alaska Economic Report with me, Ava White, on your local public radio station each week.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, it's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. Many, but not all, Alaska lawmakers are excited about the prospect. HB 50, the legislation that created a regulatory structure for a host of energy-related initiatives, is also the framework for developing systems for injecting CO2 deep underground to keep it out of the atmosphere. Lawmakers like Senator Bert Stedman, who helped get it passed, said this bill is about bringing new revenue and new opportunities to Alaska. But Senator Shelley Hughes said, I actually think it's a scam. And yet, if people are foolish enough to pay us to store carbon, I'm not going to turn them down. It's not hard to see why there would be some skepticism about what Hughes calls an invisible commodity. Does the emperor have clothes? And yet, very serious-minded scientists and officials within the environmental and industry side of fossil fuels are urgently working on many variations of carbon capture technology. Injecting it is one we'll discuss today. There are efforts to pull it right out of the atmosphere, and other innovations, such as in Iceland, where they're using technology to mix carbon with glacier dust and solidify it and leave it inert. What are the possibilities for Alaska, and what are the cautions? Here to discuss the enabling legislation for carbon capture and storage is Gwen Holdman. Gwen is the senior researcher and founding director of the Alaska Center for Energy and Power at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, UAF. And Haley Payne is in the studio with us as well. Haley is the deputy director for the Alaska Division of Oil and Gas within the Department of Natural Resources. Welcome, both of you. Thanks for being in the studio today.
Thanks for having us.
You can also join our discussion, Alaskans. What questions do you have about carbon sequestration? Do you think it's a viable economic path for Alaska's future and a way to help the climate, or a distraction from the work of transitioning away from fossil fuels? You can call us statewide at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255. If you're in Anchorage, the local number is 907-550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org. Okay, so, Haley, to get us started off, you said the conversation on carbon capture and sequestration started a few years ago. Tell us about how those discussions originated, and then describe the legislation that is now in place to start this process.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Lori. So, as I said before, I work for the Department of Natural Resources, and about 3 or 4 years ago, there was a real big sort of shift in like the investment climate. Like, folks were really concerned with and paying attention to ESG and these sorts of goals. And we noticed that there was a bit of a misunderstanding about how things are done in Alaska. How do we go about developing our resources? And folks within the administration, we're trying to look for pathways forward to show folks how Alaska does things and does it well and does it right, and that we've been doing ESG since way before ESG was cool. And so that's sort of where the conversation started. And one of the aspects of that was really looking at, like, what is your carbon management strategy? You know, how are you taking into account things to have your carbon score, be it for your production of your fuels, et cetera? So we were tasked, a group of us were tasked with looking into CCUS in terms of, like, a regulatory framework perspective
and
on
let's
that.
Describe what CCUS is.
Sorry about that. Sure. So that's the acronym for carbon capture, use, and storage.
Thank you.
Yes, absolutely. And so, you know, we already have our existing oil and gas leases and our existing regulations and statutes, and they allow for the injection of things like CO2 or other aspects when it comes to enhanced oil recovery. But this was going to be kind of transitioning away from that and looking at it from just a pure storage perspective. And so we really started to look around at other states, other countries around the world and jurisdictions, and seeing what do they have in place and does it make sense in Alaska? And so that's really where it all started. And we got to look a little bit into some of those places like North Dakota, Wyoming, Norway, Iceland, just understanding how are folks kind of looking at their pore space or those microscopic holes in the rocks as another resource potential aspect. So that was kind of the genesis of it. And then we've spent the last few years, you know, working together with partners in industry, through the university and in other jurisdictions to try to develop a framework to allow some of these things to take place in Alaska and make sure we're managing it effectively.
And in this setting, when we're talking about pore space, it's not pore as in pour out of a cup, P-O-U-R, it's P-O-R-E, which relates to porous places underground, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
All right, so we'll talk more about that and in other places. Haley, staying with you for a moment, the bill is focused on DNR and Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission, giving AOGCC sort of police powers over subsurface, also gives them some authority to pursue primacy from the EPA for these particular wells. Explain what that means for future regulatory authority or what it could mean.
Sure, yeah. So, you know, the EPA has developed the Underground Injection Control Program. And what that is that manages what type of fluid you're putting underground and designs a whole series of sort of engineering specifications, monitoring requirements, and basically the whole suite of how do you manage and regulate it if you're going to inject something underground. They have allowed for and actually encouraged states to take primacy over those programs. And what that means is that the federal government recognizes that at the local state level, we have, you know, better knowledge about what our subsurface looks like. We may be more effective at reaching those monitoring things on the ground than someone not based in the state. And so they encourage states to apply for primacy for these underground injection control programs. Currently, we have it for Class 2 wells, and Class 2 wells are those wells that are used for enhanced oil recovery. And now through HB 50, we'll be looking to pursue it for the injection of Class 6, which is a special injection class just for CO2 for permanent storage.
All right. And one last question here, Haley, and then we'll get Gwen in the discussion. I wanted to give you a chance to address skeptics like Senator Shelley Hughes, who did vote for it, but she called it a scam. What is your response to that? There are other critics who don't think it's a scam, but think it's highly unlikely the state will earn money from carbon capture, saying the costs of the technology and transport are just too expensive. What are your thoughts there?
Well, I guess what I would say is, like, you know, from a state perspective, and the reason that we set up this legislation, I think ultimately why even those who may be skeptical of the background on it still voted for it, is because we're just creating a framework. We're just creating something so that if there is to be that industry interest, if there is to be that sort of public drive, if there is to be that business case for it, then folks can take advantage of it and do it here. We're not propping it up. We're not, you know, forcing entities to engage in it. We're just creating the situation so that if you look at the business case, you look at the environmental case, people are like, this does make sense in this location, and it's important to me that my company or the company I work with engages in it, then they can do it. And so, you know, I think time's going to tell kind of where a lot of this goes. But carbon management is really, it's a part of the framework for the global economy now. You know, one way or another, how you feel about it, it's something that's to be considered. And this gives us a tool to address it.
All right. Thank you so much for getting us started. Gwen, I want to turn to you now. Describe your research and how it is separate from the state's pursuits, where it kind of complements and where it diverges.
Yeah, thanks, Lori. We've been actually looking at the university at things like carbon storage for quite a long time. Our program, the Alaska Center for Energy and Power, first got involved in this back about 2010 when we were asked by the Air Force to look at the potential for actually sequestering carbon in various different kinds of geologic formations in Alaska as part of their effort to sort of decarbonize their energy supply. And because a lot of our bases in the interior rely on coal, which are, you know, very high carbon intensive sort of energy processes, the question was, like, would there be a way for the Air Force to potentially start looking at some sort of a project that would enable them to continue to use coal as an energy source, both for electric power, but also for heating, while kind of decarbonizing that energy supply by sequestering some of that carbon that was produced from those point sources underground or in other different ways. And so they asked us to take a look at that almost 15 years ago. And that was really the first time I really had an exposure to it. And I kind of led a broader effort at the university that included a lot of people that are far more knowledgeable about the geology of Alaska and these processes than I am. But I've been really interested in this question and the role that Alaska might play in it for a pretty long time, just based on that sort of starting point.
And Gwen, you host a podcast called Closing the Gap, Stories from the Leading Edge of the Global Energy Transition from our front row seat here in Alaska. Talk about the episode where you visited the facilities in North Dakota.
Yeah, what I've been trying to do with that podcast is really bring out some stories about how we're using energy today, how we've maybe used it in the past, and then what we might do in the future. And so since carbon capture, sequestration, storage was a really big part of the discussion here in Alaska, I had a chance to go with some legislators down to North Dakota. And
was that in 2023?
Yeah. Was that 23? Yeah. Okay. And we actually went with a group to Iceland and actually looked at some of the carbon storage that they're doing there, and then we went to North Dakota also. And in particular, North Dakota, it's a really interesting sort of analog to what we might be doing here in Alaska, because they have a lot of really similar sorts of resources. And what was interesting is just seeing how they're trying to sort of combine some of these more carbon-intensive processes with this opportunity for sequestering carbon. And I should mention, like, we went specifically to go and visit an ethanol facility, and that's a really good example, and Iceland has examples, like with the aluminum industry as well, where you've got these industrial processes that are producing carbon separate from, like, producing electricity. And so if we really want to look at ways to reduce our carbon emissions, we can't just look at, like, electric power, but we've also got to look at some of these industrial processes. Ethanol production, how do we capture that kind of carbon and then do something productive with that? And so that's kind of what they're doing in North Dakota. And I think it's a really great opportunity for Alaska to kind of learn from a place that's been really a leader in sort of this space or this thought area.
Well, Gwen, I'll stay with you, but please, Haley, jump in here if you want to add. Walk us through the steps, the actual steps, starting with, you were talking about the various places to capture CO2. So starting with that source generation of CO2 and then capturing it from different sources, such as power plants, then storing it underground. How exactly does that process work?
I mean, there's really two parts to that. First of all, I mean, there's that point source capture that I was just describing. So that could be from a power plant, or it could be from some kind of industrial process where it's a more concentrated form of CO2. So that's like an easier place that you can kind of capture more concentrated.
Out of the stack.
Yeah, out of the stack, exactly. Versus like capturing it directly out of the atmosphere, right? So there's different places where you can sort of pull CO2. And so then that's the first part of that C, that carbon capture. Right? Then you can use it. So one of the things that they are doing, like, for example, in North Dakota and on the North Slope, is that we sometimes can use that to help produce more
pressurize the fields.
Yeah, pressurize the fields, or it's even like more of a miscible injectant. So it like helps reduce it just can act as like a herder where you can kind of move those, hydrocarbons to an area where you can produce them more readily. So that's kind of one of the use parts of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last one is the storage piece. And there's different ways that you can do that as well. It's not just a single solution.
Mm-hmm. And in Iceland, you talked a little bit about that. They're creating carbonate rock through an enhanced rock weathering process. How is that done?
It's really fascinating to me what they're doing in Iceland. And this is a perfect example of a country that's almost entirely decarbonized its electric power and its heating industry through the use of hydropower and geothermal energy. But yet they still have these point source carbon connected to their industrial emissions from whether it's aluminum smelting or other kinds of industrial processes. And so what they're doing there is they're capturing that carbon, they're mixing it with water and injecting that underground. And I think what's really important to understand is that the vast majority of carbon on Earth, there's a finite amount of carbon on this planet, and 99.9% of it is locked up in rocks. Right? And a very, very small percentage of it is actually in the atmosphere. And so what we really want to do is like take some of that atmospheric carbon or that carbon that's in circulation right now in living things and plants in the ocean and get it back underground where it's in a more inert form where it can stay for millions of years. And so what they're doing there is they're actually binding that CO2 with rock in this process of accelerated weathering of that rock.
Is it rendered inert forever, or if the rocks were ground up, would CO2 be released? How does that work?
No, it enters into this sort of what we call the long carbon cycle. And so the way that that carbon would later on be re-released into the atmosphere and what happens through natural processes is that when that piece of continental crust, right, that contains that carbon is millions of years from now, like sort of subducted at the edge of like a continental, you know, crust and go to kind of dives back down into the mantle where it melts, and then it kind of comes back up maybe as magma and erupts as lava through a volcano. That's where the CO2 that was in that rock is actually released back into the atmosphere. But it wouldn't be released by just grinding it into smaller pieces. In fact, that's kind of what you are alluding to in Greenland. What they're doing is because glacial silt is so fine, right? We see that blowing here in our, you know, in our river systems in Alaska. It's so fine. It has such a high surface area. It can weather at an accelerated rate just because there is so much surface area. And so it can actually, in and of itself, pull carbon out of the atmosphere through different kinds of weathering processes. So.
If you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and today we're talking about the potential for Alaska to be engaged in the carbon capture and storage industry that is sort of springing up around the country as fossil fuel generators look for ways to reduce their carbon impact and their footprint. You can join our conversation statewide at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255. If you're in Anchorage, the local number is 907-550-8422. 550-8422. In the studio with me today is Gwen Holdman. Gwen is the senior researcher and founding director of the Alaska Center for Energy and Power. And Haley Payne is the deputy director for the Alaska Division of Oil and Gas within the Department of Natural Resources. Haley, I wanted to talk about this a little later on, but we'll talk a bit about it right now. You're hosting gatherings for Alaskans to help them better understand what this is. You just had one in Fairbanks. There will be others. What do you hear from Alaskans now? What kind of questions do they have related to this technology? And what do you plan to present, or what are you presenting at these town halls?
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, going back to even when we were working on the legislation and you'd receive sort of public testimony on this, there were a lot of questions. Folks just weren't super sure about what is this, how does this work, is this safe? And so, not surprisingly, even though the idea of storage, you know, injecting things underground is decades old and something we've been doing, these different economic factors around it, the capture technologies that are being, you know, rapidly advanced, that's where the new part is. And so, the Department of Natural Resources actually received a grant from the Department of Energy. It was a $1 million grant for us to create a database that brings together public data sources in order to help map Cook Inlet a little bit better for folks interested in looking at carbon sequestration potential. As a part of this grant, federal grants have a requirement for community benefits plans. And we're actually really excited about this opportunity because, you know, we felt there was a lot of need for more information to become available to Alaskans. And so we reached out to the university and specifically to ASEP. You know, full disclosure, I'm a little biased. I was an intern at ASEP many years ago. And so and so it was a really great opportunity to get to partner with somebody who we know has kind of been leading the way in terms of talking about energy with Alaskans and providing that sort of, you know, third-party scientific feedback. And so we're going to be putting on these different town halls. We have the one in Fairbanks, and we've got two this week, one in Anchorage, which will be taking place tomorrow at the Lusac Library, and then on Kenai. There's the Discovery Center on Thursday.
That's right.
In the evenings. And so really, this is a place where we're hoping Alaskans can get those questions answered. There's going to be you know, some background information on this carbon cycle that Gwen just went into, really sort of talking about what the technology is, how does it work. We've got folks from North Dakota who have experience working on projects coming in. And then we're going to be bringing in some of our regulators, like folks from my Division of Oil and Gas, the AOGCC. So folks can kind of get the opportunity to understand what is this and then talk to the different entities in Alaska that would be engaged in regulating it and understand how are we going to do that in this state and how are we going to make sure it's managed safely. So that's really just trying to create that open forum and expand on that opportunity that was started with the legislation.
What was the interest like in Fairbanks?
I think it was a pretty good interest, you know. I think it was the first of Super Sub-Zero Day in a little bit.
It was. Yeah.
So that can kind of drive participation a little bit. But I mean, I was really happy. And, you know, I think we learned a lot, you know, based on that one. And we're kind of continuing to incorporate sort of some really great hands-on and more interactive experiences as we move forward. But, you know, I think folks are just trying to understand, you know, how does this work, like from an environmental perspective? How do we manage this? How are we ensuring that something stays down when it is injected? And they want to understand about the cost of it, the cost of capture. And so I think there's just a lot of places for that information to become available to the extent that we have it. You don't have all of the answers, but it's good to start the conversation about how we're going to get them and how we're going to study it and learn more about it.
Gwen mentioned the trip to North Dakota, and Haley, do you see Alaska designing similar setups, or how do you see it unfolding here compared to other places that are already engaged?
So, I mean, I think there's a lot that we're able to learn from North Dakota. The folks there have been incredibly helpful, you know, throughout our legislative process and also the different research arms getting to work with our university as well. But there's certain things that are just going to be fundamentally different. You know, the way they're tied in, they're on the national grid system. And so they're able to really, you know, they have these monster huge coal-fired power plants. And, like, we were laughing, the coal-fired power plant that we went to, one plant. It's more than the whole rail belt output combined. Yeah. And so, you know, the scale at some of the projects that they do is certainly going to be a bit different. But I think there are still a lot of messages about how can you learn from it. You know, they're actually looking at being somewhere that receives CO2 from other states, states that have like a big ethanol industry but don't have the ability to store the CO2. And so they're kind of looking at being able to bring in outside sources outside of North Dakota, I mean, and storing it there in their geology. And I think that's going to be one of the conversations that Alaska has as well is you know, what are our emissions, and then how else can we use this as a way to monetize that resources for other folks to use for storage as well?
Well, let's talk about some of that. Gwen, you had talked earlier in a different interview about Cook Inlet as being unique for carbon storage because of the geologic formations there. Talk about why it's got so much potential.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, when you're looking at some of these oil and gas fields that have sort of been expended. And this is true actually in Europe quite a bit too. Like Norway has a big project that they're developing right now that's really not that dissimilar to some of our resources here, our kind of geologic conditions. But when you've got a place that's been storing oil and gas for millions of years, right, under Cook Inlet, there's a reason geologically why that oil and gas has stayed underground in that location. It's a unique sort of set of circumstances, not just where you have like sort of porous or permeable rock formations, but then you've got something like some kind of an impermeable kind of cap rock on top of that, sort of like a lid on a bottle, right? And so so in Cook Inlet, you sort of have this sort of situation where we've developed a lot of our oil and gas resources, and we have this opportunity to kind of reuse this empty bottle, right? And there's no reason to believe that cap rock that has been, you know, maintaining, that's been keeping that oil and gas locked away, couldn't similarly be a way that we can ensure that we're able to store that carbon underground, which is really a component of the hydrocarbons that we've been producing, just put that back underground and continue to store that. So that's kind of what makes Cook Inlet unique. I didn't recognize that it was really the only tidewater basin on the west coast of North America, so a place that you could easily access by ship on the west coast of North America, which makes it somewhat unique.
What's known about, I'm trying to envision this big cavern underground, you're pumping CO2 into it, it held oil and gas for a very long time. How is there a way to know how much pressure it can withstand before it could possibly blow out one side or another? I mean, how do you figure that out?
Sure. And so when we talk about pore space, I mean, it does bring into the visual like this big empty tank underground, but it's
like
really
inflating it.
But it's not truly like that. I mean, we're talking about microscopic holes and grains of sand that are connected. So, but those grains of sand are confined to specific reservoirs, and especially for those that we developed with oil and gas, you can easily test and monitor for like what is the original pressure that was in place as we're depleting our hydrocarbons. We measure the pressure and we can tell like how we're getting down lower and lower into what that reservoir actually officially contained. And so you can measure oil originally, and you can also restore your reservoir to original pressure. The other really important component about CO2 storage is the EPA, you know, as a part of that Class 6 rule, pressure is very important. You're not trying to fracture or create more holes within the tank itself. And so this is going to be something that's done differently, where you're going to be putting the CO2 in, but you're not going to be putting it above that fracture point. You're not trying to increase the size of your tank. You are trying to make sure that however you're doing this, you are respecting those sort of original boundaries and not creating sort of new pathways, as it were. It sounds a little crazy, but it is like measurable and pretty easy to get your hands on. And, you know, I mean, just think about it. Like when our oil and gas is developed, I know the Beverly Hillbillies have the very famous image of, you know, like the oil like shooting out of the ground. Oh my gosh, that's not how the history of oil and gas has gone, especially in Alaska. That's not us. And, you know, and certainly we've seen evidence through, you know, the Good Friday earthquake and these other major events that have happened, and you didn't see it sort of rupturing through. So a long-winded way to say it is a measurable data point that we can actually point to, and the regulations and management of it do take that into account.
Gwen, did you want to add something?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, because I think a lot of us, when our experience with CO2 is often as a gaseous sort of form, right? And so, but if you think about like if you have maybe a can of soda, right? When it's in that bottle, or like maybe it's a clear bottle like champagne that you can kind of see, right? There's no bubbles in there while it's under pressure, right? It's not until you release the pressure that it, you know, kind of can expand and then you see bubbles, right? Mm-hmm. And so when we're putting this CO2 underground, it's not like you're this big like gas, balloon of gas that takes up all this space, you know? When you kind of squish it together, it takes up a lot less space. And so you can really think about it as just kind of in a dissolved liquid form, right? In these saline aquifers or something like that. Like Haley's saying, that's in actually kind of in the rock itself in a lot of ways, right? So that's one thing that those are the kinds of questions we really hope to kind of get answered for Alaskans. Because the point of this town hall series is not to promote the technology. It's really to get questions answered. So we're really hoping that skeptics are the ones that are going to come, because we want those really tough questions asked. I think the Fairbanks audience did a great job of asking a lot of really difficult questions. You've got experts there. You know, we want to understand this technology better from a technical standpoint, and then kind of from an economic standpoint, or what it could mean for Alaska.
And we will get to some of those economic questions in just a bit. As Talk of Alaska continues statewide, we are talking about carbon capture and storage today on the program.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you would like to play an integral part in what you're listening to, public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. If you are already a member or a corporate sponsor, thank you. If you'd like to learn more about how to become a member or sponsor, it's easy. Start with a call to your public radio station.
Start your day with a quick look at the most important stories from around the state with Alaska Morning News, your dose of headlines each weekday morning on your local public radio station.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We're discussing today carbon capture and sequestration, or carbon capture and storage. There is legislation that was passed by the Alaska legislature to look at how to build the framework for regulation and just make space for people to store carbon. In the studio with me today is Gwen Holdman. Gwen is the senior researcher and founding director for the Alaska Center for Energy and Power. And also in the studio is Haley Payne. Haley is the deputy director for the Alaska Division of Oil and Gas within the Department of Natural Resources. You can join our conversation statewide at 1-800-478-8255 if you have questions or comments about carbon capture. 1-800-478-8255. If you are in Anchorage, the local number is 907-550-8422. 550-8422. You can also email talk@alaskapublic.org. How different would the setup be to do this work compared to rigs that pull oil and gas out? Could the same sort of, especially offshore, could those platforms be used somehow for this effort in the future?
Yeah, so I think, you know, one of the, when you asked earlier, you know, what does kind of Cook Inlet have going for it, as well as, you know, beyond the geology, is we do have some existing infrastructure or potential for, you know, brownfield redevelopment. And so, you know, structurally, a platform that's placed in the inlet, you know, could be repurposed to be one that is used for CO2 storage. I think Norway may be one of the examples of somewhere where they're using, actually I think it's offshore Scotland, they're using some of their offshore facilities and using the gas pipelines and converting those over to be CO2 pipelines. And so, you know, depending on, you know, the factors surrounding the metallurgy and all that other good stuff, it is possible to repurpose and reutilize some of these aspects. So, and it looks very familiar. I mean, if you see a picture of a Class 6 well being drilled, it looks just like you're watching an oil and gas well being drilled. Mm-hmm. You know, there's some differences in terms of what kind of materials they use within the well itself. But overall, I mean, you see a wellhead with a Christmas tree on it, you wouldn't know if it was oil or gas or CO2 necessarily, just metering what goes in instead of what comes out.
A Christmas tree?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's a name for all of the bells and whistles that go on top of an oil well to blow out preventers.
I see. Okay. But the infrastructure is quite similar.
The infrastructure itself is quite similar, yes.
Interesting. So for people who are suspicious of the oil industry's motives for championing CO2 capture and sequestration process, for some folks it sounds too good to be true. What are the potential costs here? It's energy intensive to sequester, is it not? And we had an email question from Carol who said, I hope the panel will discuss energy and carbon costs of CCS.
Yeah, it is an energy intensive process. And, you know, again, like this isn't a one single solution, right? So there's a lot of local nuance to it. But that's a really important question. You know, we sometimes find things that are technically possible, but then are they really do they make sense from like a, you know, kind of an energy budget basis, right, in terms of energy, the efficiency of the process, or does it make economic sense, right? And so, you know, carbon capture and storage is one example of a technology that it does take a fair amount of energy to run the process. So the question becomes, like, depending on how that energy is being produced that you use, like, for example, if it's from fossil fuels, you may wind up, you know, with the entire process maybe not actually sequestering all that much carbon at the end of the day, or not really reducing our carbon output into the atmosphere very much. On the other hand, a place like Iceland, where you are using geothermal power or hydropower to drive the process to sequester the carbon, you're very much going to have a negative, you know, carbon footprint overall. But that's a really important question, and it's really difficult to answer it on a, you know, macro level. Like, we can talk about individual projects that have been developed. Like, for example, the Boundary Dam project in Saskatchewan has, like, a really long operating history, and we've talked to them quite a lot about what the overall cycle efficiency essentially is, right? That's also a coal-fired power plant where they're sequestering carbon, or they're actually using a lot of the carbon for enhanced oil recovery as well. So we have some numbers. We have some examples. This is also a place where the science is improving. The engineering is getting better all the time. And so, you know, we also think Alaska can be part of designing better systems and more efficient systems in the future as well.
And Haley? And yeah, I think I would just add to that, you know, the energy load of this is going to be depending on, you know, what is your concentration of CO2 that you're trying to get. So obviously the energy load of direct air capture is some of the most intensive as compared to point source capture. But then you have things like, you know, gas processing or other sort of systems like ethanol, where you're already doing something and CO2 is a natural byproduct of it in a high concentration. And so something like that wouldn't necessarily be as high of an energy intensive score because you already have to separate out the CO2. So you're not really adding to the overall, I guess, energy intensity budget of it. So I think it just depends on what you're getting that CO2 source from. Is it an industrial byproduct? Is it point source capture? Is it pulled right from the atmosphere?
And that's like the kind of example of like where we can talk about very specific case studies. Mm-hmm. We'll be doing that during the town hall too.
Well, let's talk a little about the direct air capture. Is that something that's being considered for Alaska, and how does that work?
I mean, I think direct air capture is certainly something that's being looked at here. And so
it's like slurping it right out of the air.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I think one of the sort of easiest ways to visualize it is maybe just to think of a lot of giant fans, essentially, that are kind of drawing in the air from the atmosphere and then running it through a filter. And then there's like usually an amine or something on that filter that's going to trap the CO2, and then it releases the rest back out into the atmosphere itself. Mm-hmm. And then you, of course, take that CO2, compress and store. But I mean, I think it's got a lot of really great potential here because some of the things that you need for it are, you know, a strong source of energy and you need, you know, space. So those are two things that we really have. And what's interesting about it, and what I think a lot of the focus in, is pairing it with some of your stranded renewable resources or some of these other things that have a lot of energy potential, but because of where they're located, it's not really, you know, conducive for powering a community or something like that. But you could use some of these really huge resources that we have here in Alaska and unlock it in a way where you're actually pairing it with direct air capture, especially if you have it over like a suitable geologic storage location. So just differences.
Yeah. All right. Well, thank you. Let's go to the phones for a moment. Ethel is in Soldotna. Hello.
Hello, good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I have, I just brought up another question in addition to the ones that generated this telephone call. Number one, I'm really curious to know whether or how much information has been gathered about what the actual physical the physical capacity this state has to sequester carbon. And while I'm at that, I'm curious also to know what, if any, comparisons have been made about how much carbon can be sequestered independent of where the best locations might be, versus the energy consumption that it would take to do that. And then the second part of my call deals with what if anything, the ALGCC or the regulatory agencies have done to examine how the state can take advantage of this in terms of offering tax credits or other tax structures in place to encourage the development of additional income for the state by taking advantage of not only these programs, but how to use oil and gas industry or other carbon emission reduction efforts to add to the state's coffers and stuff.
All right. Thank you, Ethel. I saw my guests taking notes here, so I'll give them an opportunity to answer. Haley, do you want to start us off?
Sure. Maybe I can start with a couple of those, and then Gwen can supplement there. Thanks for those questions. So in terms of, you know, how much physical capacity does Alaska have to store? So at a very broad level, we've done some high-level screening. There was one of the first studies done on this was back in 2011 that the state actually worked on and looked at, you know, at a basin-wide level how much we could potentially store. And it took some initial estimates from the USGS and downgraded those. So what the estimates are is that at a statewide level for saline aquifers, which is one of the places you can store it into, you could be looking at like 1,600 gigatons, which is sounds like a made-up number. But and for reference, I think the entire globe is something like 31 gigatons a year for energy for CO2 output.
Wow.
Yeah. And so, you know, but this is also kind of looking at places that, you know, could be offshore or hard to access. So these are just very high level numbers, right? You know, they've looked at unmineable coal seams, and that's really that study and looking at the depleted oil and gas fields is where those numbers that come behind Cook Inlet and talk about, you know, 50 gigatons of potential there. And so there's been some high level estimates. We know we have way more emissions than we have. We could certainly be a huge player in terms of supporting, you know, other global partners who need a spot to store it, but you need to do site-level screening, and that's really the next step that Alaska is on, is you've got to get down and really understand at more of that reservoir level, because, you know, just like not every oil and gas field contains the same amount of oil and gas, even if it's in a productive area, you've got to kind of get down into those individual fields, and I think that's really what we're starting to see folks take the next steps on. One of the other ones that I might address is the AOGCC question. I think there was something asking about, you know, tax credits or taking advantage of that. And the state of Alaska did not, within the legislation, introduce any sort of tax credits or incentives for parties to participate in this. As I said, we're trying to be very just neutral about that. But the federal government has taken sort of a step in on tax credits. And so that's really what's helping to drive a lot of the economics in projects here in the U.S. is there are general tax, there can be tax credits based on what type of storage you're capturing from and where you're storing it. And so the federal government's sort of providing some of those incentives, but the state itself is not going to be subsidizing or providing like tax credits for it. We do see this as being a revenue positive opportunity. As a part of the legislation, we set some minimum value numbers for if folks are going to get a lease from the state and store their CO2 here. The baseline charges, and these can, you know, be negotiated and be different, but it would be roughly $20 per acre or $2.50 per ton of injected CO2. So these were some of the baseline numbers where DNR will be generating revenue through the storage of CO2 in state pore space.
And how did you come up with the numbers? Did you look at other places and what they're charging, or how were you able to do that?
Yeah. So we did a pretty exhaustive kind of look around the U.S. and around the globe. And, you know, interestingly, a lot of the places that were first movers on that are other states where they don't own the resource. So there weren't as many public contracts. Mm-hmm. but we're starting to see more of those, like Texas, Louisiana. They have a lot of university and public land trusts that have public documents we're able to get. And so we developed these sort of calculations based on what was kind of considered to be kind of a general industry standard. But then again, allowing ourselves sort of that opportunity to continue to negotiate and find other mechanisms. Like some folks have things like rent or an injection charge, but you can expand on that and say, okay, I want a share of revenues, or I want a minimum guaranteed annual payment. But all that's a bit in the weeds.
Well, thank you for unpacking some of that. We're going to take another quick break, and then we will continue our discussion about the potential for carbon capture and storage in Alaska as Talk of Alaska continues statewide.
Talk of Alaska is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. One of the greatest honors for a public media station is delivering on its promise to provide quality programming and news you can trust to the communities it serves. What you hear on air is the result of a dedicated team working together to bring you the best. It's a privilege to be a part of your day. Thank you for listening, for your feedback, and for your support.
Talk one-on-one with experts on mental health, nutrition, pharmacology, surgery, childcare, and much more on Line One, your health connection. Join our hosts as they discuss the health topics that matter to Alaskans with their guests and live callers. Email questions before, during, or after the live broadcast to line1@alaskapublic.org. That's Line One, your health connection, weekly on your local public radio station.
The greatest compliment to a public media station is when a listener becomes a member. So do your part today by becoming a part of the team officially. Thank you for making a donation.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We are today talking about the potential for carbon capture and storage in Alaska, in Cook Inlet, on the North Slope, and other places. You can join our conversation with, we have in the studio today, Gwen Holdman, who is a senior researcher and founding director of the Alaska Center for Energy and Power at UAF. And Haley Payne is the deputy director for the Alaska Division of Oil and Gas within the Department of Natural Resources. You can join us statewide at 1-800-478-8255. That's 1-800-478-8255. If you're in Anchorage, the local number is 907-550-8422, 550-8422. You can also email us, talk@alaskapublic.org, as Julie did. Julie writes, hello, CO2 mixed with water is highly corrosive in metal pipes. How would you account for this? Haley.
Yeah, Julie is absolutely right. So CO2 is corrosive when it interacts with water. And so one of the things I mentioned before was the Class 6 well program designed by the EPA. And it does recognize some of those corrosive properties. And that's why there's different mechanisms and limitations and specifications of what kind of materials you can actually use in order to build your well, transport it. This involves also pipelines as well. And so there's work to make sure that you are using the proper equipment for the job. And then also, you know, just at a base case, whenever you're getting your CO2 prepared for injection, you're going to be cleaning it, dehydrating it, compressing it. And so the CO2 is going to be sort of stripped of all any sort of water associated things like that and be as highly concentrated and pure as it can be. So I'd say everything from, you know, when you're first capturing it to when you're injecting it, you're really taking that into account because it is a really important consideration.
So let's talk about if this gets going and all of a sudden we have people in Japan who want to, businesses in Japan who want to ship CO2 to us. Talk about how that works. Does it have to be liquefied somehow? Is that how it would be shipped? And how labor intensive or energy intensive is something like that? And then, of course, we're transporting it great distances. How does all that square?
yeah, so I mean, I think It is a journey, right? but sure, there's been a lot of work actually in communications between even our the White House and the government of Japan. I'm really trying to unpack and understand this question. There was just a study that was finalized and I think released a couple days ago that was the Department of Energy looking into just those questions, like what do the ships look like? What has to be their sort of size specifications? What are the costs for transport? And where would be suitable locations, actually looking at Alaska in terms of a statewide levels, is where is the bathymetry suitable for a ship of this size to be able to go to? And in a lot of ways, it mirrors LNG transport. You know, I mean, this is another gas that we compress, that we, you know, get down into a liquid form and then put on tankers and send out to sea. And so there'll be a lot of similarities in terms of that respect, but a lot of work is actually being done right now in Korea, in Japan, designing and starting to build some of these ships. They've actually already been commissioned. And so this, you know, it sounds very far off, but they're being built right now.
Wow, that's really interesting.
Yeah, the federal government's taking a close look at it as well and has helped to, join these studies with Japan to really understand where that opportunity is.
Well, because a country like Japan doesn't actually have any native CO2 storage opportunities. Mm-hmm. And so if they're going to look at this as one vector of meeting their decarbonization goals, they're going to need to find a place that's willing to, like, warehouse, that's willing to store their carbon. And, I think Alaska and Japan, for example, have a long history. Mm-hmm. Wasn't the first LNG project that ever happened was between Alaska and Japan? Is that true?
Yeah. So we invented LNG export from the Cook Inlet to Japan.
So it's just really like another.
So they know the route.
Right.
All right. Let's jump to the phones for just a moment in our final few minutes here. David is in Anchorage. Hello.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. Do you have a question?
All right. I have a question. What about the rest of the pollutants that come from burning coal, like the heavy metals, like mercury and lead, sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxide, all of that?
Excellent question. Thank you, David.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I'll take that one because I live up in Fairbanks. Yeah. And so, you know, I'm at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. We actually potentially maybe one of the last coal plants ever built in the U.S. is at the UAF, and it's a, you know, heat and power plant there. And one thing these more modern coal plants in particular, and most plants in the U.S. have really been either retrofitted or designed with, like, really good kind of processes to sort of address some of those other sort of nasty emissions that can come from coal. Now, that's not true sometimes in other places in the world, so that's the kind of thing that we want to be thinking about. But at least in the U.S., like where we have the technology to sort of capture a lot of those particulates and other sorts of, whether it's heavy metals or things like that, and dispose of them.
Hmm. All right. Thanks for the call, David. For both of you, does the advent of this technology, we've heard of forestry set-asides for a long time in other places, and in Southeast Alaska that's been happening for quite some time. Does this, the sort of advent of this technology, make that idea of forest set-asides less appealing or sort of obsolete? This is a much more aggressive way to try to manage CO2 than the passive system of forestry set-asides.
It's also potentially a more long-term solution, right? Because those forestry set-asides, like, that's really still part of this sort of short carbon cycle, right? The biologic sequestration or storage of carbon in living things, right? Those trees are going to die at some point in time, and that carbon is somehow going to re-enter the atmosphere. Whereas, like, what we're looking at here is a more permanent solution. Personally, I believe we need to do all of the above. These are not exclusive to one another, and it also doesn't displace the need to decarbonize our energy supply more broadly. So it doesn't reduce the need to transition to renewables, for example. I think that this is sort of one of these all of the above sorts of opportunities. This is not a single solution. We need more renewables. We need to look at sort of biologic storage of carbon as well. There's a lot of things that we can be doing, and there's different places that have different opportunities to engage or participate in that sort of, you know, decarbonizing our global energy supply.
How is industry involved, or has the fossil fuel industry been involved in both looking at creating this legislation, and are they involved in your work at the center, Gwen? Haley, I'll start with you.
Sure. Well, I'll just kind of start. You know, I think the oil and gas industry has really leaned into, you know, being a leader really in terms of the development of this technology and its implementation. I mean, they have the skills. They go and they drill wells. They characterize reservoirs all the time. And so it's this, you know, broad suite of training and equipment and manpower really that they're putting towards this, and so you will see especially in the lower 48 some of the like ExxonMobil is probably, you know, chairing one of the biggest sort of carbon capture energy projects at this moment, and here within the state we had, you know, a lot of industry interest in us moving forward with this, because, you know, just recognizing that in order to move forward with certain projects, I think Santos is a really great example. You know, they're developing the Pikka oil field right now. And when they came out to do it, they're an Australian-based company, and they made the pledge that they were going to try to be, you know, get towards, like, you know, carbon neutral or have very aggressive carbon mitigation goals. And they're doing it through the use of offsets, and as well as they'd also like to be able to do underground carbon storage. And so they were certainly involved in and paid attention to and helped us on, you know, as we were working through the legislative process. And that makes sense, because the regulations and the statutes were all based on our existing oil and gas ones. and so we took a lot of learnings from our experience in oil and gas and are now applying it into carbon sequestration.
All right. And Gwen, my question to you about, yeah, is the fossil fuel industry involved in your center and research?
No, not with the Alaska Center for Energy and Power. What we've been really careful about is to sort of separate the role that industry might play and the role of really getting impartial, accurate, scientifically accurate information out to the public. And so we actually did this previously with nuclear as well. And similarly there, we were very careful not to take any funding or sign any NDAs with industry. You know, we really want to be on the side of the Alaska public and make sure that they have really good information so that they can make the best decisions for the future of our state.
Fantastic. Let me get this last question in here. This is one from Bill, who says, thanks for the great information. Outreach, there are recent examples of loss of methane from infrastructure and gas fields. If the OG industry cannot avoid large leaks of methane, how will the industry monitor CO2 leaks and assure CO2 is indeed transported without leaking and sequestered? What will motivate the industry to ensure that this waste gas isn't just leaked away? After all, the more gas that disappears is a profit. That kind of cues up a question that I had about, is there going to be some sort of like a super fund created for the future of what could happen, unforeseen things? If Japan starts shipping a bunch of CO2 over here, who pays in 50 years if there are problems? And who monitors, as Bill asked?
Sure. So there's a lot of questions there.
Yeah, sorry. What, 30 seconds or so?
Okay. I will say, you know, it's not the industry that's going to be regulating its transportation and storage. It's going to be those entities, agencies at the state and federal level have been entrusted to do so. I will say there is an economic incentive for them to also to be able to responsibly manage and sequester it, because if they'd like to collect the 45Q tax credit, then they need to have that measured volume stored. And then I forgot the last part of the question.
Well, there be some sort of a fund, like a super fund?
So we do have set up in HB 50 a long-term monitoring and maintenance fund. So 50 years after the closure of a site, the state has a trust fund available in case it needs to do anything.
All right. Thank you so much. That queued it up and wrapped it up nicely. Thanks so much to my guest today, Gwen Holdman, Senior Researcher and Founding Director of the Alaska Center for Energy and Power at UAF. Thanks to Haley Payne, who is the Deputy Director for the Alaska Division of Oil and Gas within the Department of Natural Resources. And thanks to our team. Our engineer was Dave Waldron today. Our producer is Madeline Rose. And on the phones, Ava White helped us out. Thanks for listening today. I'm Lori Townsend. We'll be back next week.
Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.
Programming on KSDP is supported by the Schumigan Corporation. Located in Sand Point, the Schumigan family of businesses includes property and equity management, the Sand Point Tavern, the Anchor Inn Motel, and the Anchor Inn Lounge. The Schumigan Corporation, serving its shareholders and the people of Sand Point, on the web at www.schumigan.com or by telephone at 907-383-3525. The Schumigan Corporation. Hometown Values and Service, a proud sponsor of KSDP.
KSDP, 8:30 a.m. in Sand Point, K201DA, 88.1 FM in King Cove, KOLD, 91.9 FM in Cold Bay,